Israel has a message for Hamas.
We call Hamas terrorists to surrender.
The most significant climate regulation in American history.
The standards that have been approved are really going to help provide significant benefits towards our climate, our air quality, and human health as well.
And Major League Baseball opens in South Korea.
These are the first ever Major League Baseball games in Korea. And this event is definitely Korean, with all the edge of your seat energy that baseball fans here love.
Today is Thursday, March 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. The armed wing of the Palestinian militant group Hamas released on Wednesday video said to show fighters attacking Israeli forces close to Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. The footage showed fighters carrying missiles, targeting Israeli forces, and an explosion at a tank. Israel's military said Wednesday it had killed around 90 gunmen.
In this compound, many Hamas terrorist operatives and senior ones have been hiding in the hospital. And also Islamic Jihad group has been hiding in this hospital. When we entered the hospital, we were finding terrorists fighting against us here in this area. Until now, we have arrested over 250 Hamas and Islamic Jihad terrorists that we identified.
IDF spokesperson Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari.
We have supplied yesterday two generators to the emergency room because there was a problem with electricity. We are supplying also technicians to fix the problems inside the emergency room and the generators. We are also supplying medic teams to assist with everything or anything that is needed. We found in the compound over 11 million shekels used by Hamas, giving the money to his operatives to conduct terror from the northern Gaza. Hamas have tried to control again Shifa Hospital as a hub to conduct all its terror mission in northern Gaza. We call Hamas terrorists to surrender.
Israeli forces killed three Palestinians and wounded another in an airstrike in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said in a televised address on Wednesday that preparations were underway for the invasion of Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip, but that such an action will take some time.
I want you to know that I've already approved the IDF's operational plan, and soon we will also approve the plan to evacuate the civilian population from the battle zones.
United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres on Wednesday urged Israel to ensure that humanitarian aid could reach Gaza and called for international support to the UN's efforts in the enclave.
I call on the Israeli authorities to ensure complete and unfettered access for humanitarian goods throughout Gaza and for the international community to fully support our humanitarian efforts.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken will travel to Israel this week, part of his sixth urgent mission to the Middle East since Israel's war with Hamas began in October. Hamas is a U.S.-designated terrorist group. Relations between Washington and Jerusalem have soured dramatically in recent weeks. Still ahead, the Biden administration has announced new automobile emissions standards that officials call the most ambitious plan ever to cut planet-warming emissions from passenger vehicles. We're following these other stories from around the world. European Union leaders met in Brussels Thursday amid growing calls for Europe to dramatically ramp up its defense spending and industry. The two-day summit will also address other contentious issues, including the war in Gaza, future EU members, and immigration. Leo Varadkar announced on Wednesday he was stepping down as Ireland's prime minister in a surprise move, saying the country's coalition government would stand a better chance of re-election under another leader. A court-ordered auction to sell the historic home of Myanmar's imprisoned former leader Aung San Suu Kyi failed to attract any bidders on Wednesday, according to legal officials and a journalist who attended the event. The house and nearly 1 hectare property in a prime area of the country's largest city had an estimated price of about $90 million, which appeared to be one of the reasons deterring any bids. A day after the World Meteorological Organization declares a climate change red alert, the Biden administration has announced new automobile emission standards that officials call the most ambitious plan ever to cut planet warming emissions from passenger vehicles. It's being called the most significant climate regulation in American history. Joining us now to talk about this is Kathy Harris. She leads the Natural Resources Defense Council work on clean vehicle policy and programs that accelerate the transition to zero-emission passenger cars and trucks. So, big news, yeah?
The standards that EPA have announced today are actually the strongest ever tailpipe pollution standards and are ones that are going to deliver 7 billion tons of emissions reductions, which for equivalency, that's actually equal to the amount of pollution that the United States emits in 1 year. So the standards that have been emitted are really going to help provide significant benefits towards our climate, our air quality, and human health as well.
So the rules are being called the most significant climate regulations in American history. Would you say that's true?
Yes, I would say these rules are a very good thing and are really going to help us to achieve those climate goals that we need to, given this strong climate crisis that we're in.
The industry is moving itself in that direction. Consumers want electric cars, don't they? I mean, weren't the manufacturers moving this way anyway?
Yes, absolutely. We've seen EV sales increase from customers year over year, and the auto industry has already invested over $210 billion to help accelerate this industry here in the U.S. alone.
Walk us through, timeline, what this regulation does.
So this regulation takes effect for vehicle model year 2027 and goes through vehicle model year 2032. So it's important to remember that EPA, when they're considering these standards, they're not technology standards. They're really focused on pollution coming from a tailpipe. And automakers can choose to meet compliance any way they see fit. That could be a more efficient gasoline vehicle, a plug-in hybrid vehicle, a regular hybrid vehicle, or even a battery electric vehicle. The stringency requirement will decrease year over year till we reach a final stringency number in 2032. And EPA is projecting that by 2055, that stringency level will help to reduce carbon pollution by 7.2 billion metric tons.
So try to put that number in a way that we can understand what that means.
7.2 billion metric tons is actually more than the United States emits as a whole in 1 year.
So this is a significant reduction in carbon.
Yes, this is definitely a significant reduction in carbon pollution.
So there are other benefits, right? I mean, cutting carbon, obviously the goal, but cutting carbon brings other things.
In addition to those reductions of carbon pollution, there's significant health and net societal benefits associated with these rules too. EPA is projecting that $2.1 trillion in net societal benefits, including $247 billion in direct driver benefits, and $240 billion in health benefits. And that directly impacts human health. We're going to see reduced asthma attacks and reduced premature deaths as a result of these rules.
What is the driver benefit? You said direct driver benefit?
$247 billion in direct driver benefits. That is related to reduced fueling and maintenance costs of the vehicles.
It is a significant difference. When we were on the car lot looking at the electric cars that they did have, and if you read the data, it's a significant, like the amount of gasoline you don't buy is significant. like money in your pocket.
Yeah. Yeah, we're seeing even today that the cost to fuel and maintain an electric vehicle is significantly cheaper than the cost to fuel and maintain a comparable gasoline vehicle. And in the regulation, EPA is anticipating, as a result of this rule, drivers will see a reduction of their owning and operating costs of about $6,000 per vehicle.
Over the life of the vehicle?
Yes.
Interesting. Thank you so very much for the time.
Yes, thank you so much, Scott.
Kathy Harris with the Natural Resources Defense Council. A Russian missile on Wednesday hit an industrial area in Ukraine's northern city of Kharkiv, killing 5 people and injuring at least 7, causing a major fire in a printing house. The Kharkiv region, which borders Russia to the north and lies close to the front line, has suffered regular attacks during Russia's 2-year-old invasion. White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan was in Kyiv on Wednesday. He became the second major U.S. administration official in 2 days to say that a major U.S. aid package that has been blocked by Republicans for months would get to Ukraine, and vowed that Washington's support would continue.
We have stood by your side since this war began. We have provided enormous support, and we will continue to do so every day in every way we know how.
Russian troops occupy more than a sixth of Ukraine's territory and are on the offensive again after weathering Ukraine's counteroffensive last year. Moscow has been inching forward in the east as Ukrainian troops face shortages of artillery rounds, manpower problems, and question marks over the depth and strength of their defensive fortifications. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. A battle over a strict immigration law enacted in the state of Texas remains in legal limbo. The federal government is suing to block the measure that would allow state authorities to arrest and deport migrants suspected of entering the U.S. illegally. The measure is on hold after a series of back-and-forth court decisions that have gone all the way to the Supreme Court. VOA's Lori London spoke with Joe Paul, professor of constitutional law at the University of California, San Francisco.
It's becoming a really intensifying fight between Texas and the U.S. government over securing the U.S.-Mexico border with Texas. What's going on here? Isn't the U.S. Supreme Court the ultimate decider here?
Well, the procedural background to this case is extremely complicated. But effectively, what happened in this instance was that the Texas law, SB 4, would have allowed officers in Texas to arrest and to deport people that they suspected were undocumented aliens. And this raises both constitutional questions, both in terms of the federal power over immigration and also with regard to the risks of racial discrimination. The district court in Texas put the law on hold. Then a panel of 3 judges of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in Texas decided that they would stay, that is, they would prevent the judge's order from coming into effect for an administrative period of time, that is, to give them time to sort of review all the papers. That case was then appealed up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court decided that they would allow that administrative stay to stay in place until such time as the Fifth Circuit had a chance to review things. So the case went back down to the Fifth Circuit, and then later last night, the Fifth Circuit, a different panel of judges said, nope, this law is unconstitutional, we think, so we're not going to allow it to take effect. And that's what happened.
What's the Biden administration's main argument?
The Biden administration has 2 concerns. The first concern is that the courts have consistently held for over a century that states have absolutely no authority over immigration. Whether it's legal or illegal immigration doesn't matter. States cannot take actions to enforce immigration policies of the federal government, nor can they do anything to interfere with those policies. that is exclusively a federal power. In fact, our Constitution was really founded in 1787 in large part because the states were interfering in our foreign relationships. In this instance, the government of Mexico is screaming that they're not going to take aliens who are being deported by the state of Texas, and they're going to court as well to object to the enforcement of the Texas law. So the first argument that the president is making is that this interferes in his authority to regulate our foreign affairs. Secondly, there's the question that how does a police officer in Texas decide whom he or she suspects is an undocumented alien? Just by looking at people? Obviously, it's an invitation for racial discrimination, and that's in violation of the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause. So those are two very strong constitutional objections to the enforcement of the Texas law.
And where does it go from here?
So what we expect will happen now is that the case will go back down to the district court, where the district court will presumably reach a final decision on the merits of the case. Then it will probably get appealed back up to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and then it's very likely going to end up in the Supreme Court. But if the courts decided that the state had this power, it would reverse a century of court holdings. For example, as recently as 2012, the Supreme Court held that Arizona could not make it a misdemeanor for an undocumented alien to engage in work in the state. The court said in that case that Congress had made a decision to punish employers but not to punish the alien themselves in the event that an undocumented alien sought work. So the state of Arizona, even though it was acting in a way that was consistent with federal policy, the court said they had no authority to criminalize the status of an undocumented alien. And it would be remarkable if the Supreme Court decided now to reverse a century of its own decision-making.
VOA's Lori London speaking to Joe Paul, professor of constitutional law at UC San Francisco. Australia and the United Kingdom on Thursday signed a new defense and security cooperation agreement. British Defense Minister Grant Shapps.
We are living, as I said in a speech at Lancaster House in London, with your Chief of Defense Staff present back in January, in a world which has moved from a post-war world that we've always considered we've lived in to a pre-war world where, not because we're about to go to war tomorrow, I hope, but because we need to be more prepared than ever before, our stance needs to change.
Australian Defence Minister Richard Marlis.
This is a status of forces agreement, which contains within it a commitment to consult between our two countries when there is a contingency which involves our sovereignty and our security.
The UK had a much bigger presence in the Indo-Pacific region than it has in a long time and said it would send a carrier strike group to the region next year. Marlis said that Britain would contribute to a submarine rotational force in Australia. Australia is boosting defense, interoperability, and military exercises with the United States and other regional partners after a defense review last year said China is undertaking the largest military buildup of any country since the end of World War II. And finally, South Korea is hosting its first regular season Major League Baseball games this week as the professional U.S. League opens its season in Seoul. The games between the Los Angeles Dodgers and the San Diego Padres feature stars from both South Korea and Japan, often bitter rivals. But Koreans aren't letting their difficult history with Japan get in the way of cheering for Japanese players, as we hear now from VOA's Bill Gallo.
These are the first ever Major League Baseball games in Korea. And this event is definitely Korean, with all the edge-of-your-seat energy that baseball fans here love. But there's also no question who is the biggest draw in Korea.
Shohei Ohtani.
Ohtani.
Everyone likes Ohtani.
Shohei Ohtani, the do-it-all Japanese megastar who draws massive crowds everywhere he goes. He's even popular in Korea, which has a painful colonial history with Japan. Seoul baseball fan Ah Soo Young says he's tall, he's handsome, and that other stuff, that's an old story. I don't think it means I shouldn't support a Japanese player. Koreans don't always love Japanese stars. Ichiro, another baseball legend, taunted and sometimes even insulted South Korea. Yuji Ho is a Seoul-based sports reporter.
But Ohtani has been the opposite of that. And I think the fans here appreciate that. And also, I think that a lot of the young baseball fans have been able to move past that sort of historic angle to Korea and Japan's sporting rivalry.
This week, it's positive vibes between Korea and Japan, which are coming together around an American game. U.S. Ambassador Philip Goldberg is attending opening day along with Korean and Japanese officials.
In this atmosphere of better relations between Korea and Japan, but also Korea, Japan, the United States, it brings even more luster to the whole event.
Ties between Korea and Japan have improved as both countries set aside the past and focus on shared challenges.
It just makes so much sense. It's in the interests of the three countries. There are going to be, you know, moments where we have to manage and go through different periods. But I think there's a logic to all of this that will keep it going.
But for how long? Anti-Japan sentiment often flares up in Korea over issues like Japan's use of forced labor during the colonial era. Even now, it's a factor. Reports suggest Japan's prime minister was planning to watch this week's baseball game with his South Korean counterpart, but didn't because it may have been too controversial ahead of next month's election in South Korea. Benjamin Engel is a professor at Seoul National University.
Even though the two governments have been able to kind of smooth things over, this historical issue hasn't been solved, I think. It's just not that easy to be like, this is our shared interest, let's act in that, and let's set aside all this baggage that hasn't been addressed fully.
But at least for now, Korean and Japanese fans can come together and enjoy what they love the most. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul, South Korea.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walter.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is a Pacific nation, and we share longstanding historic and cultural ties with our Pacific Island neighbors, said Daniel Crittenbrink, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asian and Pacific Affairs. U.S. prosperity and security depend on the Pacific region, remaining free and open, prosperous, secure, and resilient. Assistant Secretary Crittenbrink said the Pacific Islands face significant challenges to their security and prosperity, including from climate change and economic shocks, and from problematic behavior by an increasingly aggressive People's Republic of China.
We are not in the business of forcing countries to choose, neither in the Pacific nor anywhere else. But we do want to ensure that countries in the Pacific have a choice and the ability to make their own sovereign decisions free from coercion.
To that end, the United States will provide more than $7 billion in funding for key agreements and new programs in the Pacific Island region. That includes funding for the Compacts of Free Association, an agreement with Palau, the Marshall Islands, and the Federated States of Micronesia that allows exclusive military access for the United States in return for economic support. Those compacts, said Assistant Defense Secretary for the Bureau of East Asian and Pacific Affairs Eli Ratner, are of utmost importance.
These agreements provide assured access for our operations, and they prevent would-be adversaries from accessing sovereign FAS land, airspace, and territorial waters. The bottom line is that the compacts help secure a part of the Indo-Pacific that is larger than the continental United States. We also know that the PRC is drawing from a range of coercive tools in an attempt to erode long-standing U.S. partnerships and advance China's own influence.
USAID Asian Bureau Assistant Administrator Michael Schiffer said USAID offers Pacific Island countries a different way.
A tailored development model responsive to their needs and their aspirations, rooted in economic, trade, and integration, in inclusivity, in locally led solutions, and in the democratic values that can positively transform our shared planet.
Meeting these goals, said Assistant Administrator Schiffer, depends on enhancing cooperation with local communities, individual countries, as well as Pacific-led organizations. The United States will continue to deepen its diplomatic, defense, and development engagement with the Pacific Islands region. As Assistant Administrator Schiffer declared, enduring presence matters.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.